Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Tuesday, the 16th of July. Coming up on the program, the Transport Minister on new private sector participation in freight and logistics. A look at South Africa's nuclear power potential as work is accelerated on a new locally made reactor. Post the assassination attempt, are Donald Trump's election prospects increasing, and the negative impact of climate change on tourism? The newly installed Transport Minister, Barbara Creasy, says she wants to further private sector participation in South Africa's rail network and plans to establish a dedicated unit in her department to pursue this goal. She joins us on the program now. Minister, first of all, what specific criteria will then be used to identify suitable areas for private sector participation, both in rail and in ports?
Greetings, Jeremy, and thanks very much for inviting me on your show. I think that first and foremost, one must say that there is a general recognition that the infrastructure of our rail network would remain under state ownership. But obviously, what we are interested in looking at is increased third-party participation in operations. You would understand that we've got a lot of problems in our ports and also on our freight corridors, rail freight corridors. We want to try and move in terms of the national rail policy to a situation where we are getting more freight off the roads and more freight into rail. But obviously, there are certain constraints in terms of budgets. And so we think that also having private operators would be a good idea. Now, this PSP unit has not yet been set up, but the department has been doing the feasibility work. I think that what we are wanting to do is establish a unit that would be able to call for expressions of interest, but would also have the capability to ensure that such expressions were properly structured from a financial point of view and would have the necessary sustainability.
How do you convince the private sector that this is a good play, given the inherent risk that still exists within the logistics sector in South Africa?
Look, I think that there is already interest and appetite in third-party participation in the logistics sector. The National Logistics Crisis Committee, I think, is testimony to the interest that the private sector has in participation. I think this is why I was emphasizing the fact that such a unit would have to have the necessary skills and would be able to ensure financial stability. Obviously, there are still questions with regard to maintenance of the corridors. There are still big questions with regard to security. And that it is, and of course, overall, there needs to be a greater focus on transport planning so that we have a very clear picture which everybody can share and understand as to where we're going to in the medium to long term with the transport sector, so that there's a degree of security and confidence for those who might be interested in participating.
critical, of course, Minister, that measures are taken to ensure that any private sector involvement doesn't lead to higher costs for businesses relying on rail and port services.
Yes, I think that that is absolutely critical. And there is a new economic regulator for the transport sector that would have responsibility for ensuring that we do regulate costs, and clearly that economic regulator would be responsible both for state provision and also private participation.
So you talk about the vision going forward as far as the rail and logistics sector is concerned, and again, we don't have to go back over the difficulties that it's faced in the past, but what are you working towards? What sort of goals should be in place?
Well, I think that what we understand is that in a modern economy, rail needs to be the backbone, both of your passenger services and your freight and logistics system. At the moment, as we all know, we've got an enormous amount of freight on the roads. Not only is that a danger to citizens because of the increases in accidents, it's also obviously doing tremendous damage to the road infrastructure. So I think the vision is to try and reverse that situation. But obviously, and this is why this planning unit is so important, what we have got to look at is this very large infrastructure that Transnet has, a whole range of branch lines. One has to understand the economic viability of those lines, and one has to understand where would there be appetite for private operation, and also to understand where would it be necessary to continue with state operation because one requires those lines for broader economic purposes that may or may not have private sector viability.
Is there a sense that Transnet has become a more positive proposition? Are you confident? Is the department confident that the recovery plan, this much vaunted recovery plan, is moving quickly enough?
Look, I think one of the things I'm very grateful for is the fact that there is a turnaround strategy in the form of the National Logistics Crisis Committee and the Freight Logistics Roadmap in place. And I must pay tribute to my predecessor, Minister Chukwuka, for pushing this recovery to be in place. I think that what we know is that currently there is a plateauing of the number of tons that are moving through the corridors and moving through the ports. Part of that plateauing is because there is very serious infrastructure work, maintenance work, and replenishment work of the corridors that has to be done. And part of it is because of the security situation. You know, this is early days for me, Jeremy. I'm doing an enormous amount of learning and visiting. And this is where I will be focusing my attention so that I understand how we can get the basics right in order that we continue with the optimization of the existing freight system.
Do you think there is an appetite within the new government of national unity to try and get this right? I'm interested to know how much attention was given to the transport portfolio at the Cabinet Lekgotla, and I fully understand that more details on the meeting will come out in the State of the Nation address, which takes place later this week. But are you confident that there is a uniformity of thinking here?
Yes. Yes, I think that's why I say that, you know, I'm very lucky because there is a turnaround strategy in place. And the elements of that strategy were included in the priorities and the sub-priorities that were put before us and which we generally agreed on. So I feel that I do have the political support in cabinet. I mean, you know, clearly there are always issues that arise in the course of implementation that will have to be further tested. But Jeremy, I've done turnarounds before. And one of the things I've learned is that when you're a new minister, it will take you 2 years to put the turnaround strategy on the table. So this is why I say I'm very fortunate there is a plan on the table. Obviously, plans can always be improved. Implementation can always be speeded up. But I really feel that I have something substantial to work with and to be able to support in implementation.
Transport Minister Barbara Creasy, thank you very much for joining me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Eskom has been granted a license extension to run Unit 1 of the nuclear power station Kooburg for another 2 decades. At the same time, a first-of-its-kind reactor that requires something in the region of 9 billion rand to build has been developed in Pretoria by South African engineers. I want to talk now to Dr. Kelvin Kem. He's a nuclear physicist and former chairperson of the South African Nuclear Energy Corporation. And Dr. Kem, firstly then, what's your reaction to Eskom being granted this extension?
Absolutely. It's a great thing. In fact, what's happened now with Kooburg is that they revamped the one reactor by putting 3 new steam generators into it. And it's quite amazing the magnitude of that job, and people should be proud of the Eskom people. Each of those steam generators is the size of 2 municipal buses end on end, and each weighs more than a Boeing 747. And the 3 old ones were cut loose, unbolted, turned sideways, taken out of the building, and the 3 new ones were taken in and put in place and so on. So the one reactor is now up and running with the new ones, good for another 40 years. The license is 20 years, and that is an excellent move. And Kooburg currently produces South Africa's cheapest electricity by far. So as time goes by now, relatively speaking, the electricity will be even cheaper because it's dead steady.
So that would be the key advantage as far as that is concerned. Are there any risks attached to this development?
No, not at all. Not from a nuclear point of view. It was a very reasonable thing to do. The biggest risk is somebody falling off the top and breaking their leg or their neck or something while they install it. But certainly from a nuclear point of view, there's no risk. The reactor is now even safer than it ever was before. But even so, the dangers of nuclear power are well and truly exaggerated. And nobody has ever been killed by radiation from a pressurized water reactor like Kooburg. So the history of these things is excellent. And Kooburg is known to be particularly well run by international observers. We watched carefully, and it's excellent.
Dr. Kem, a lot of conversation now around the development of a first-of-its-kind reactor in Pretoria. Could you explain to me what has happened and what the potential is for South Africa's nuclear capability?
Well, if you have a look at the map of South Africa is essentially an inverted triangle, so to speak, with the top right-hand side being Upper Mpumalanga, top end of KZN and so on. And all South Africa's coal essentially is sitting up there. And so we, in the past, supplied the whole of the nation with coal coming from the top corner, which is not a good idea. And way back in the 1960s or so, the government of the day realized this and decided we've got to put more electricity from the bottom up. So Kooburg was built down at the bottom, so the electricity is coming up. But still, most of the electricity is coming from the top down. And as the economy increases in size, it's not a good idea to have everything coming from only one place. So in the 1990s already, an Eskom team started to look at the problem and said, we need electricity where the gold mines are, where Sasol is, and so on, in the middle of the country. So we need something that will not run on coal, not run on gas, because we didn't have any. Nuclear was the answer. But what we also needed was we needed nuclear that did not need the ocean for cooling or any cooling of water, because you need then a very large dam. We don't really have that, because the few large dams we have, the height can vary dramatically, because in South Africa we can have droughts for 5 years and so on. So it had to be non-water, and it had to be able to be put anywhere. So the idea was born to develop from scratch a small modular reactor which is gas cooled. It's cooled with helium. So you can literally put a cross on a map anywhere you like, and you can put the reactor there. So you can take the power source to where you want to use the electricity. And that's a huge thing. And we started developing in the 1990s. That was called the Pebble Bed Modular Reactor. And around 2010, the project went on to ultra slow, where it stayed ever since. A private group eventually reformed of scientists and engineers and continued development on a similar line and developed what is today known as the HTMR-100, based in Pretoria. And South Africa was the first country in the world to start developing a commercial small modular reactor.
So is this at conceptual stage, Dr. Kem, or how long would it take to get it into some degree of operation? Can you give me a sense of timeline?
Okay, it's not at conceptual stage. We're ready to build. And from now, if we start tomorrow, 5 years, we can be producing electricity. We've got the thing well and truly all worked out. We also developed the fuel. Everything is in one place. And we've been getting a lot of interest from around the world, actually. And it's quite heartening to see what's happening. But we're ready to go.
So what's the next step then, in your opinion?
The next step is we need big money, like 9 billion rand, which is dirt cheap, by the way, by world standards. Others are like five times more than us. So that's not it. And that's over a five-year period. And we've been getting international funders have traveled to South Africa, a number of them, to come and have a look and see us and shake hands and have a look to see what we claim is all true. And we've now had a pipeline effectively opened into Europe for money flow, one into the UK and one into the United States. And for example, the European one took something like 6 months of due diligence. They checked everything and came here to see us face to face to check that what we were telling them was true. And eventually they said, okay, they're now prepared to go to their clients, raise this amount of money and assure them that the money can flow to South Africa. And at the South African end, there's reasonable people, a reasonable project, a reasonable support of government and so on and so forth. So it was a huge thing to have this essentially line of access officially opened up by these big international dealers.
How confident are you that this is going to come to fruition?
We're dead confident. All over the world now, there are small modular reactors evolving in various countries. By far, the majority of them either need water cooling or some other strange thing. So they're not in the same category as ours. But all the small modular reactors in the world now came about because of South Africa. We were the first, and they said, you know what, this is not a bad idea. And in the last couple of years, 2 years to 5 years, nearly all the others have come about very recently. So many of them are very much in conceptual stage, and we're way ahead of them.
Dr. Kelvin Kem, thank you very much indeed. Nuclear physicist, former chairperson of the South African Nuclear Energy Corporation. That really is good news. Good talking to you today. I appreciate it.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Donald Trump has announced his running mate and has appeared at the Republican convention in Milwaukee in Wisconsin with a bandaged ear after the weekend assassination attempt. Daily Maverick associate editor Brooks Spector is with me now. He writes on American politics. And Brooks, firstly then, how are weekend events changing possibly the election trajectory?
Well, good to be with you, Jeremy. I mean, the first thing that has to be said is that whatever the difficulties that Joe Biden has had, the incumbent president has had in articulating and enunciating his views on any number of issues and the election, of course, that has disappeared in the wake of the attempted assassination of Donald Trump in Butler, Pennsylvania. And now, of course, we're in the middle of the Republican National nominating convention, which has officially nominated Donald Trump for president and Senator Vance for vice president. Joe Biden's campaign continues, but one barely hears anything about it after his public statement that everybody must tone down the incendiary rhetoric, which is sort of an obvious thing to have said, but it needed to be said.
That rhetoric, though, is not going to tone down anyway, is it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, if you were watching any of the speeches at the Republican National nominating convention, the rhetoric was there. It was muted slightly. And there was an awful lot of praise to the divine presence and the idea that Donald Trump is, in fact, a manifestation of divine guidance. But the political divide in the country, as you know, really is deep, and it is partisan, and people have lined up on alternate sides of it. And it's going to be very hard to keep it under control over the next 3.5 months, let alone on into the future after that.
Brooks, you've got this almost deification of Donald Trump, and you certainly have a weakened Joe Biden, certainly if his debate performances are anything to go by, a lot of questions still around his age. Where does this leave Biden and particularly his security on the ticket?
Well, the discussion that was in and among Democratic Party supporters and journalists who were favorable to them and Democratic Party office holders after in the immediate aftermath of the CNN Atlanta debate was growing in intensity, partly because of the direct evidence of Joe Biden's inability to be articulate in that debate. Subsequent to that, he's given some interviews, one to George Stephanopoulos and another one scheduled for Lester Holt of NBC, and a very fiery speech in Detroit, and then the press conference following the NATO summit. There were a couple of gaffes in there, but that's almost become a trademark. So the idea that Joe Biden is incapable of carrying out a conversation, that's gone away. But the idea that Joe Biden has the energy and has the support and he has the stamina to continue this struggle, this fight for the nomination and for the election, the problem is he himself had said he wanted to be the transition figure from the past and into the new generation of politicians. And the Democrats have a deep bench of politicians, all of whom would likely have seen themselves contesting the nomination if Joe Biden had chosen not to want to run again. Now, it'd be very hard for anybody to say, I'm openly contesting Joe Biden's nomination for the candidacy for the presidency. And I mean, I've said this in a number of different ways. There's really only two people who could possibly convince Joe Biden to step down from his quest to be reelected. One of them is the person he's married to, Jill Biden, who could very clearly say to him, Joe, I really think you need to reconsider this. I want you around for a while. And I guess the other one is Nancy Pelosi, the former Speaker of the House. And she and Joe Biden have had a long political partnership, goes back decades. And if the two women were to tell him, we really think this is for the good of the country, the party, and the person, he might well consider it. But so far, at least, he's been very clear that he is running and he expects to win. But the problem is, of course, that Donald Trump and his new partner, J.D. Vance, present a formidable team of people who, although much of what they say is dubious in its truth and much of what they say is misstatements or misleading, they have the fervor of their supporters on their side in a way that supporters of Joe Biden are not.
Brooks Spector, let's talk about J.D. Vance if we can. He is a senator. At one point, he was one of Donald Trump's huge detractors, likening him, if I remember correctly, to Adolf Hitler. Has he undergone some sort of Damascene moment to come back into the Trump orbit? And is he a MAGA heir to Donald Trump, do you think?
Well, let's take that second part first. At the age of 39, I think more than almost anybody else among Republicans, sees himself as the heir to the throne of MAGA-dom, whatever that word must be nowadays. Gosh, that sounds odd, doesn't it? But he's bright. Somebody explained that he, uniquely among Republicans, although he's probably not capable or willing to explain the views of academics and the commentators to the MAGA mob, he is eloquent and capable of explaining ideas of the MAGA horde to academics, to the commentariat, and to other Republican politicians, and maybe uniquely gifted that way. He had a very hard scrabble beginning in his life, rural West Virginia, in certainly lower class white rural West Virginia. He joined the Marines to get himself out of that, came back a changed person, went to university, got a bachelor's degree, went to Yale Law School, did well there, came from there, joined the IT world of Silicon Valley with Peter Thiel, got himself elected to senator in the state of Ohio a couple of years ago, and he underwent, if it wasn't a Damascene conversion, he was certainly on his way. He went from being a never-Trumper to being the most fervent acolyte you can find. Opportunism may be an operative word here.
I'm going to leave it there. Brooke Spector, thank you very much for talking to me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally, we've all witnessed the difficulties being experienced in the Western Cape due to extreme weather. And my next guest, Kaitano Dubi, Faculty of Human Sciences Acting Research Professor at the Vaal University of Technology, says these severe storms are set to disrupt tourism in the future. So, Professor, welcome. And what are you worried about?
The worry we should have is also closely tied to, I think, the economic importance of our coastal tourism, particularly in South Africa. So you would know that in terms of our coastal areas, for example, in recent days, we have seen an increase, particularly in the extreme weather events. That has proven to be quite disruptive in terms of tourism activities, but also most importantly, in terms of the infrastructure that we have in our coastal areas. So we have witnessed, I think, an increase in terms of loss and damage that is related to extreme weather events on coastal tourism. But also, if you remember, not so long ago, we had an extreme drought that also shook, I think, the tourism enterprise, not only in the coastal province, but also in the inland provinces. And as a result, we have seen a tendency for the country to receive low numbers in years that we actually experience extreme weather events, be it in the form of droughts, be it also in the form of extreme rainfall events. Particularly, I think what is of significant concern in these days, quite recently, is the damage on our coastal infrastructure, which the tourism establishments might not have the money to actually repair and also maybe to recover from such shocks.
And most telling, of course, is the economic impact. If you look at the flooding in 2022 and 2024, this year in KwaZulu-Natal, it's had devastating consequences, hasn't it?
It did have devastating consequences. Remember, one of the challenges I think that we have seen, particularly in KwaZulu-Natal, has been, I think, the every time you have because of, I think, challenges that we have experienced in terms of our infrastructure in urban areas, we have also seen effluent waste actually finding itself in the beaches, which have had a long time impact on beach tourism, for example, in KwaZulu-Natal. And we saw that running through and affecting its peak season, which is normally during the Christmas period. So the long-term impact of such extreme weather events is particularly telling. They lost a lot of holiday homes, but the impact, particularly on beaches, has been in the form of E. coli, increase in E. coli on our beaches, which is problematic.
So what this means is better risk management is needed and broader measures need to be taken to improve the resilience of tourism and infrastructure or tourism infrastructure to mitigate against these eventually.
Yes, indeed. So there's need really to rethink the infrastructure within the South African space across, I think, all the facets of the tourism industry, because that infrastructure has to be de-risked in light of the climate extreme weather events that we are experiencing. And some of the infrastructure might need actually to be relocated so that we reduce the impact and also the damage and loss that we have experienced. The engineers also have to rethink. If you think about the roads and also the drainage system that we have within some of the areas, they need to be readjusted not only in KZN, but we have seen the impact of increased intensity of tropical cyclones in areas such as Kruger National Park, which normally become a victim of tropical cyclones.
It's also about better urban planning, and it's often something that local government is not particularly good at.
Yes, so we have seen, I think, the decline in the deterioration in urban governance, particularly in South Africa, not only in South Africa, but in Africa as a whole, and the impact of that has had on tourism and also other economic activities is actually worrying. So I think better management of our urban infrastructure and also rural infrastructure, because most of our pristine areas are in rural settings. So think about the Garden Route. It's not really an urban area, but these are areas where people can actually enjoy. So there's been concerns that I'm sure if you follow the news closely, small towns such as Naisna, about urban effluent finding itself in the estuary, which is quite damaging in terms of tourism and also the destination image.
Professor Dube, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed from the Faculty of Human Sciences at the Vaal University of Technology. I do appreciate your time today. And before we close the program, on our online poll today, more private sector involvement in the freight and logistics space. That's according to the Transport Minister. She was on the program a little earlier. What do you think? Finally, too late, or let's wait and see? If you have a view on that, so you can participate in the poll either on our X or on our LinkedIn pages. On our online poll yesterday, GNU properties, or priority, should I say, and over half of our respondents saying the economy trumps crime and corruption, and also fixing state-owned enterprises. That's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.